My next guest is Tarik Dennison, Director of Cross-Border Wealth at GFM Asset Management. They're an investment advisor based in both Hong Kong and the U.S. And Tarik has an extensive background in wealth management. He served at Bear Stearns and J.P. Morgan in New York, CIBC in Toronto and London, and Societe Generale in Hong Kong. He also currently teaches fixed income and alternative investments at Essec Business School in Singapore, and he's written a book. It's called Invest Outside the Box. Tarik is on the line with me now from Hong Kong. Tarik, so glad to finally connect. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Nate.
So, Tarik, we're going to focus on what I think are two extremely interesting topics right now, emerging markets and Bitcoin. However, before we do that, you actually have the honor of being the first Asia-centric guest we've ever had on this show. And so before we talk EM and Bitcoin, I just love to hear, can you give us some sense as to the ETF landscape in Hong Kong and broader Asia, just in terms of adoption and perhaps how ETFs are viewed overall?
Oh, of course. I mean, I'll try my best to do it in a short amount of time. I mean, first of all, Asia is an enormous and a very, very diverse place. Usually you would want to start in Japan, which is one of the most developed parts of Asia. It is the largest ETF market out here, one of the largest in the world after the U.S. And the unique thing about that is that the largest ETF buyer in Japan is the Bank of Japan, is the central bank. I mean, imagine if the Federal Reserve were the largest buyer of SPY or the largest financer of SPY by comparison. And then if you look at Greater China actually breaks down into three major parts. You have mainland China, you have Taiwan, and Hong Kong. That's what we refer to when we talk about Greater China. I'm based here in Hong Kong, which is the most open and most accessible of the Greater China ETF markets to foreign investors. But still, when you compare what the ETF market is like here, it will look like the U.S. ETF market back 20 years ago, maybe back in 1999, where fee levels are still relatively high. The focus is still a lot more on short-term trading than long-term asset accumulation. And there's still a much, much greater dominance of sold, not bought, high-fee active mutual funds compared with anything that you see in the ETF space.
And is it just that more education is needed in those markets?
Yes, very much so. I mean, I would say generally out here, things traded on stock exchanges are still thought of as trading instruments and not really places to keep wealth. If you speak to most people on the street in Hong Kong and you say, well, where would you keep wealth? Where would you invest your bonus? They would either buy an insurance policy or they would buy another investment property. They still don't think of funds traded on stock exchanges as a place to keep wealth.
Okay, Tarik, so I know you're well-versed in many areas of the financial markets, but I thought we'd hone in on emerging markets and Bitcoin this week, primarily because these are two topics you and I have batted around on Twitter, which is actually how we met. So let's start with emerging markets. It's really been a lost decade for broad emerging markets, significant underperformance compared to U.S. stocks. I know you think we might see a reversal of this over the next decade. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you have to look at it, I think, even longer term. I wouldn't even quite call it a lost decade. I would call it a general decade of underperformance. If you look at the U.S. compared with almost every other country tracked by MSCI, the U.S. was the third best performing market of every single country over the past decade. The only two countries to outperform the U.S. over the past decade were Kenya and Jamaica. And I don't think anyone listening to this knew that, or you know, very, very few expected it. And the main reason, if you go back 10 years, was expectations. 10 years ago, everyone was still really worried about the U.S. No one was very optimistic about it. We weren't expecting 10 great years of recovery and boom and Federal Reserve reflation. On the other hand, at that time, everyone was optimistic about China. Everyone thought, oh my gosh, China's going to keep growing at 10% per year. China's going to take over the U.S. And those were reflected in valuations back then. So the story of the past 10 years is just as much a flip in expectations as it is what you might call a lost decade. Just as you remember with Japan in 1990, that was the worst time to invest because everyone thought, well, at 100 PE, stocks in Japan were actually underpriced. So the moral of the story is, don't get too excited when valuations are high and buy where valuations are low. If you look back the past 30 years, basically, EM underperformed in the 1990s and then really outperformed in the 2000s and underperformed again in the last decade. I think we're going to see that pattern repeat in part because of what the valuations are telling us.
Okay, so on that note, I agree. I think the consensus out there is that U.S. valuations may be on the higher end and emerging markets look relatively cheap. But of course, valuations aren't great short-term timing tools, right? And I feel like many people have been saying for a while now that EM is going to turn the corner and outperform. I guess the question I have for you is, what could be the catalyst here? And more importantly, how should investors think about allocating to EM right now? Because again, we could go on for another several years with EM underperforming. That's possible.
Well, one thing I think it's important to not think of EM as a broad category. What actually really impressed me when I looked into it, there is 10 times as much allocated by U.S. investors to China in just broad EM funds as there are in any China-specific funds. So clearly, from a U.S. investor point of view, there's not a lot of discernment between China versus India or versus China value versus China growth. So I think there is still going to be a lot of opportunity for those who actually don't just say EM is a broad category, but will differentiate between EM quality, EM value, and other factors, which will differentiate the good returners and the bad returners. One thing that defines an EM, an emerging market, is relatively low levels of financial quality and financial disclosure. So by simply weeding out the high-flying growth stories, the frauds that will fall 90%, you can already start outperforming an EM. So that's one thing I think we're going to see more of as these markets become more accessible and there's more choice for investors in how to allocate.
Well, I think you make an excellent point. EM, it's not ubiquitous, right? There are major differences between the countries. And I think some people think of it so broadly that you lose sight of the fact that the individual countries underneath are really what's going to drive returns. And I guess on that note, you mentioned China. Obviously the trade war is still hanging out there, the Hong Kong protests. So I feel like that's been on the back burner a little bit in terms of media exposure, but certainly nothing's changed there. What is the case for allocating to China, which does tend to have a healthy weight in many emerging market ETFs?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and again, you can't just think of China as one big monolith. When you think of the trade war, it's not as though everything listed in the CSI 300 is a factory exporting things to Walmart. You have lots of businesses in China which are very domestically focused and really aren't that affected by the trade war, at least not to a first or second degree. If you think of a company like Guizhou Maotai, for example, they make a highly alcoholic spirit, which is pretty much only sold in China. They still haven't really even developed a brand for export yet, although that's something I think we should expect to see more of in the next 10 years. They really haven't been affected by the trade war in the same way that, say, a Foxconn has or any other business who's much more focused on trade, especially trade to the United States. One of the other stories I think you hear, which is a broader EM story, they said that Vietnam, for example, is going to be a great beneficiary of the trade war as American production shifts from China to Vietnam. So far, we haven't really seen that yet, but we have seen it in Vietnam's valuations. So if you were to ask me, medium term, I would actually probably expect several companies in China to outperform those in Vietnam purely just on a valuation point of view.
Tark, how important do you think a weaker dollar is to emerging markets? Because I know there are some who will argue that's basically all emerging markets are, is a play on a weaker dollar. Do you agree with that?
I think that's an oversimplification. Yes, a weaker dollar is important. So especially for emerging market companies that have borrowed a lot in dollars. I mean, the best thing for you is if you borrow dollars, you want those dollars to be weaker, so you're paying back in cheaper dollars. But that's not all there is to it. You can actually see many, many companies in emerging markets that don't have that much debt. I mean, one example that I've written a lot about is China Mobile. China Mobile provides, is the largest mobile phone carrier in the world. They're 75% owned by the Chinese government. They have very little debt, so not a lot of U.S. dollar debt. They're not going to be really affected by whether the dollar goes up or down.
All right, Tark, before we move on, because I want to make sure I leave a little time for us to talk Bitcoin. From an ETF perspective, if investors do want exposure to emerging markets, what do you think are some of the most important factors to consider? How do you like to get exposure to emerging markets via ETFs?
Well, I because I'm here, I can actually allocate to some emerging markets directly. So, for example, we do buy shares in Chinese stocks through Stock Connect and listed here on the Hong Kong Exchange. But as far as ETFs, one thing that you mentioned earlier, I am a cross-border wealth manager. So I will buy U.S.-listed ETFs for U.S. clients, and I'll buy non-U.S.-listed ETFs for non-U.S. clients, mostly for tax purposes. I am very, very familiar, of course, with the very large ones like VWO and IEMG, and I spent a lot of time explaining those. But I like going down a little bit further and trying to find EM value, EM quality. So, for example, one of my favorite EM ETFs is EMGF, which is purely a multi-factor ETF. There is also an EM value and EM quality ETF, but those are listed in London and not really good choices for U.S. investors. So that's something I spend a lot of my time just going through and picking out.
Any concern with owning state-owned enterprises?
Ah, I'm glad you mentioned that. So one of the ETFs I looked at was one with the ticker XSOE. So it is an EM ETF that specifically screens out state-owned enterprises. I don't treat it as a blanket category. Just in general, I find state-owned enterprises aren't really run with the shareholder in mind in the same way. And I've said this with the example I gave earlier about China Mobile, is if you look at their dividend and their payout ratio, they're clearly not running the company with the shareholder in mind. They're running it with the customer in mind because they're 75% owned by the Chinese government. The Chinese government wants to give everyone cheap cell phone service. That's not always going to mean that you get great dividend increases over time. So that's something to keep in mind.
All right, Tark, I do want to pivot and talk Bitcoin. We have to get to what I know is a favorite topic of yours in a Bitcoin ETF. I have a surprise for you. So I actually pulled a few of your old tweets. And these are responses you had to me. I think everyone knows I'm a Bitcoin ETF proponent. But I've got to say, I absolutely love these tweets. You certainly paint a picture. And so first, I tweeted out a Wall Street Journal article on a Bitcoin ETF where the question was asked whether the SEC is a merit regulator or whether investors should be able to decide for themselves what to invest in. And your response was this, quote, "The SEC is primarily a disclosure and anti-fraud regulator, not a merit regulator. Like the FDA, they won't let you package cocaine in a pixie stick and sell it to kids." Obviously, the analogy here being Bitcoin equals cocaine and the ETF wrapper is the pixie stick. I thought that was great. Let me give you another one. Continuing with the kids theme, you also tweeted, quote, "There's a 50-50 chance the FDA approves cannabis products in junior school lunches before the SEC makes it too easy for brokers to stuff Bitcoin in grandma's retirement account." And then I'll give you one more here. You said, quote, "Putting Bitcoin in an ETF is like taking the newly invented wheel and carrying it around in a handheld basket. A clear step backwards and nothing but a money grab."
Yep.
So give us your quick summary here. What do you have against a Bitcoin ETF?
Well, I think you've said, why do we have a Bitcoin ETF when we have ETFs on things like natural gas futures? And I say, unlike almost anything else that we've had ETFs on, is cryptocurrencies have the technology to actually take assets, to take something like the S&P 500 and wrap it in a security token, which is far more efficient than the ETF structure itself. Taking a cryptocurrency and wrapping it in an ETF is like using your email software to print out letters that you then take to the post office and mail. it really defeats the purpose. And really what I'm saying in all of this is that I want to direct the attention away from price speculation on whether cryptocurrencies go up or down, and instead divert that attention to actually developing cryptocurrency and blockchain technology to solving real-world problems. One of the things that we have here in Hong Kong is that we still use paper checks and paper signatures in a day and age where nothing should be done like that on paper. I mean, I say, when was the last time you went to the post office to send somebody information? But that said, we're still writing paper checks. And, you know, even when you trade an ETF electronically, there's still back office settlement, which is not same day. It's not, you know, done on the blockchain. It's T+1, T+2. And we should be moving beyond that rather than taking something that settles electronically and wrapping it in 20th century technology.
Well, I think that's fine and certainly a good longer term goal. But what about investors who right now want exposure to the price of Bitcoin and they want to hold it in their, let's say, their brokerage account at Schwab?
Well, first of all, Bitcoin is not an investment. That's something that I am making clear. And, you know, maybe you're going to push back and say that's me arguing that the SEC is a merit regulator.
That was going to be my next response.
Yes, but at the same time, this is my view as an investment advisor. It is not an investment. It is a speculation, and those who are suitable to speculate in it can already access it directly. The only thing that this does is it adds extra layers of complexity, extra layers of cost for those who really don't understand it enough and really shouldn't be speculating in it, because if they understood it, they would just trade it directly. And that is my view. Is like, unlike, say, physical gold actually had costs and risks associated with taking delivery and shipping and authenticity that GLD and IAU solved. And that doesn't really work with cryptocurrencies, because any software that you can download on your phone or on your desktop can already verify it and already help you do that. So I do see, in many ways, compared with natural gas, compared with gold, compared with anything else that's been wrapped in an ETF, cryptocurrencies are a fundamentally different animal. And I really think it's important to appreciate that rather than just jump in, bless a single cryptocurrency, which is very energy efficient, energy inefficient, and encourage price speculation on it rather than development of its applications.
Well, something that I do want to point out, while I'm a proponent of a Bitcoin ETF, I think some people misconstrue that as me recommending everybody put Bitcoin in their accounts. The way that I view Bitcoin is really as a venture capital investment. It could be a home run. It could go to zero. I think that's the best way to think about it. But in terms of the rationale to own in a portfolio, look, there's a lot of data out there that shows if you just had even a small allocation to Bitcoin in a well-diversified, globally diversified portfolio, you could improve the risk-adjusted returns of that
difference
portfolio.
But the huge difference between Bitcoin and venture capital is venture capital, you're actually investing in the development of something. You know, if you were a VC investor in Uber, you're actually helping pay for software developers to develop software that helps you book rides and get from point A to point B. The thing is, Bitcoin does not do anything like that. It is scarcity as a service, and nobody needs scarcity as a service. There are plenty of other cryptocurrencies and plenty of other distributed applications which have more real-world applications, which for example, will allow you to develop security tokens or allow you to do digital signatures or allow you to verify the authenticity of something digitally. Those are the applications I think we really need to focus our efforts developing.
I don't disagree, but again, I think that gets into making a judgment on the merit of Bitcoin as an investment versus whether or not it should be wrapped in an ETF. And I think there should be a distinction there. And I know you're not speaking on behalf of the SEC. I just think from the SEC standpoint, that's where I guess I have the biggest problem is I think that there's being judgment made on the investment merit. I think that should be left up to investors to decide. And I'll also mention there are other ways for retail investors to access Bitcoin outside of just owning the crypto direct or going to a crypto exchange. The Grayscale Bitcoin Investment Trust, that's out there. That thing trades at 20-25% premium. Institutional investors can arbitrage that and really make money directly off retail investors. There are Bitcoin futures out there. And I just feel like a Bitcoin ETF would be a better mousetrap for people who do want to access that in a brokerage account or in a convenient way. Again, whether or not you or I agree if it's a good investment.
Sure. And I think if you some of the other things that we haven't debated quite as much, I'm also a big opponent of a lot of leveraged and inverse ETFs in the point that I certainly don't believe that they belong in many investors' accounts who can easily access them. It's because usually leveraged and inverse ETFs, for example, wrap things that can be accessed in futures contracts. And my view is that if you can't trade futures contracts, wrapping it in an ETF doesn't make it good for you. You know, and the examples that I gave earlier about, you know, cocaine and pixie sticks or other things like that is just because you put it in a wrapper doesn't make it healthy. And that's why I say is acknowledge what that white powder really is and just snort it directly rather than pretending that wrapping it in something colorful makes it healthy.
Well, I think that is the perfect place to end. I'm sure you will continue to beat me up on Twitter every time I tweet on a Bitcoin ETF. Tarek, really enjoyed finally connecting. Excellent perspective this week. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Nate. Thanks for having me.
That was Tarek Dennison, Director of Cross-Border Wealth at GFM Asset Management.